right, tonight's gospel story lesson for our class is going to come from Matthew chapter 5, verses 1 through 12, section of scripture you'll recognize when you get there, known as the Beatitudes. We're going to do a few weeks. I don't know if I'm going to do the whole Sermon on the Mount, but we're going to at least do some of it. I'd like to do a couple of lessons out of the Sermon on the Mount this week and next, Lord willing, and consider some of its lessons. I'll tell you, I was surprised when I was working on this. I've worked through the Beatitudes before, but this time I wanted to branch out a little bit and take a look at a few resources I hadn't checked before, just to see if there's something out there, you know, I ought to consider that I hadn't thought of. And I guess I was surprised by how diverse some of the opinions are on the Sermon on the Mount and what to do with it. And that was interesting. So we'll discuss that a little bit tonight. What I'd like to do is engage you in some discussion. I know in the auditorium it is really hard to have a discussion class because this half can make comments that this half can't hear and so forth and back and front. If you're loud enough that I can hear you in your comments, I'll try to repeat them for the group. If your comment is short enough for me to remember from end to end what you said, we'll try to make that work. But that's the goal. So I'll go through a couple of verses. Actually, we're going to read all of it. And then I'm going to take part of it and discuss it for just a few minutes, and then we'll have a couple minutes of discussion, and then I'll talk a little more and a little more discussion. We're going to try that tonight, see how it works. Let's read together verses 1 through 12. Seeing the crowds, he went up on the mountain, and when he sat down, his disciples came to him, and he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you." Okay, so we're going to take this, instead of going verse by verse, I'm going to take it together and talk about them, kind of three or four separate points that all of them share in common. So first, we call these Beatitudes because they start out with blessedness, blessed. Most of the newer translations haven't even bothered to change that even though there are some other options. Blessed is the favorite because it sounds right. It wouldn't quite sound right if we said, y'all are kind of happy if you know, it wouldn't quite come across the way it's supposed to. So even though the word blessed is not one we use a lot in modern speech, you don't walk around and say, I'm feeling very blessed today. Some people do, but in our common kind of secular world, it's a word that you hear less and less. The translators have said that's just the word we need there, and for good reason. Happy really probably wouldn't get it. In some of your Greek grammars, it'll suggest that happy is a possible translation, but I disagree, and I don't think any of them push it real hard for this reason. Happy is tied to circumstance, or the way I remember it, happy is tied to happenstance. You're happy because of what happens. Good things happen to you. If I come by and say, hey, I found $10, and I think I owed you some. Here you go. Have a good day. Well, you're happy. You got 10 bucks. I come by and say, hey, you owe me $10, pay up. You're not so happy anymore. You lost 10 bucks. Okay? Happy is dependent on what happens to you. But if you look in this section of Beatitudes, the things that are happening, none of them actually sound very good. They are things that would not make you happy, but there is a description of these people that is blessed. There is something that continues even when you're persecuted for righteousness' sake. Or something that's not even an emotional state. I don't think this is descriptive of how you feel inside. I think this is a description of what you are. If you look in dictionaries, in Greek dictionaries, they'll say this word means in a fortunate or privileged situation, which again I think is kind of funny because he's describing unfortunate and unprivileged situations. So put that definition into the sentence. You are in a privileged situation when others persecute you for righteousness' sake. Yeah, that kind of sounds funny, right? I mean, it could be that Jesus is on purpose saying something that just sounds ridiculous, right? You are in a great situation when people try to kill you. that he's on purpose trying to rearrange the way we view the world. What words do we use for that in kind of our secular culture? Something good happens to you, you say, "I was lucky," or "that's very fortunate." And I've noticed this about myself. I say that a lot. Something happens, I say, "Oh, how fortunate, how lucky. If I'm lucky, this is what will happen." As if there's some cosmic force in the universe known as luck that actually controls what happens. You know, it's almost a superstitious view of the world when I talk that way. And I've caught myself saying, "Why do I say it that way? Good luck. Why don't I say God bless? Why do I say good luck?" You know, as if, again, there's some mystical mistress known as luck who's going to roll the dice and see if you have a good day or not. You know, why do I even talk that way? But we do. A lot of us do. Those are terms that our culture uses. The Christian sense is best translated as blessed. The God of the universe has determined that this situation is for your benefit. And so it is called a blessing. And you can view it as a blessing and act as one who is blessed. You can consider yourself to be in a good circumstance when these things are true, because God has declared them to be good, even if your common sense or your neighbor says, "That doesn't look good to me." God has declared it good. So here, the normal use of the word is being set in opposition to what follows, which sound like very unfortunate circumstances. So my first discussion question for just a couple minutes, you might have a thought on, you might not. Do we talk like this as Christians? Is this the way we talk about things that happen? I don't mean in church. I mean afterwards. When we go in here, it's always, "Oh, God bless you," you know. But when we get out there and we talk to our coworkers, do we talk about life in those terms? Do we talk as if we believe circumstances are either good or bad, depending on what God thinks of them, that God, in some sense, is ultimately in control of the universe, and that the most important thing is not whether I'm lucky or fortunate, but whether I've been blessed by God? It's just a different way of talking about things. Do we talk this way? Why or why not? Go. David?
I think, unfortunately, that in our frail human weakness and worldliness, we fall trapped and victim to that world of unlucky. I don't believe in luck.
Yeah.
I don't believe in coincidence. I believe in the divine blessings of God.
Yeah.
And I think that if our faith is strong as it needs to be, then we will see God manifesting himself in our lives, and we will see those blessings from God, yeah, and not just blind luck.
Yeah. I think it is something that we learn as we mature as Christians, a different way to look at life. And some of you had the great good blessing, of course, to be in the workshop yesterday on James. And James, the book of James, has a discussion about this. How do you see the events of life? Do you see it as, "Here's my plans and let's hope it works out"? Or do you see it as, "If God wills, we'll do this. If God wills, we'll do that"? But it does take a level of growth in Christ to kind of learn. It's like learning a new language, because you come to it and we've heard it talked about this way. And I do think as we grow in Christ, we learn there's a different way to talk about our circumstances. We first consider who's in control of the universe and what he might think about what this is. Is that kind of what you're getting at, you think?
Yeah. And I think we make a mistake in trying to part of, not trying to, but maybe even in error, or we marginalize God.
Yeah.
We put God in the box and we don't consider that God's blessings from God. Sometimes.
James, we're going to do this next quarter, James in the auditorium. Not this James, James the book. James is going to teach James for a couple of weeks. But James has a lot to say about that. Every good gift comes from above and cometh down from the Father of lights, in whom is no variableness, neither shadow of turning. How he views everything that happens is first through the lens of his faith. And he just talks about things differently. And so I've had to really reckon with that personally, because I grew up in churches and talking about the Bible, but I've always kind of had a skeptic's eye to the world and looked at it and wanted to view it, you know, as a scientist or whatever, and have tended to exclude a lot of language about God from my speech. And I used to think it was funny when people didn't. You know, why do people say it that way? And then you hear James talking exactly that way, and you think, maybe that's how Christians talk. And so it's been something I've reckoned with a little bit I'm still not good at it. I still say, good luck, y'all. And as if, you know, again, there's some divine power called luck who rules the universe instead of my God. It's something to think about. Bill?
Man, I spent a lot of years living in the upper Midwest outside of the Bible Belt. Moving back to Oklahoma in the Bible Belt, you're much more likely to hear someone talk about a blessed day.
Yeah.
Going through the grocery store, the cashier, have a blessed day.
The guy at McDonald's drive-thru just the other day said, have a blessed day, sir.
Yeah. Never heard that outside of the Bible.
Didn't hear that outside of the Bible Belt, yeah. So it is, the way you think about the world does dictate the way you speak. And just to be clear, I'm not trying to be judgmental and say if you say good luck, you're fortunate that you're just in sin. I'm just saying that it does change your word selection a little bit as part of that. And I think that's for the best. That I like the idea, as we said this morning, that Christians are unnatural. We don't sound like everybody else. We do describe circumstances different. The Romans noticed this when they persecuted the church. They said, boy, you must be miserable. And they said, we are blessed to suffer in the name of Christ. And the Romans thought, these people are nuts. Until they converted. And eventually Christians won. So, something to think about. Just how do you describe your life? What words do you use? Might say more about how you view it than you think. And that's one of them. So, to ponder that. Good. The next thing I want to look at are the traits themselves. It's an interesting list of traits. If you were going to pick out 10 things you think are important, or 8 things you think Christians ought to do, it's an interesting list. Poor. Now, Matthew has poor in spirit. Luke doesn't have in spirit. If you read the Gospel of Luke, it just says, blessed are the poor, period. You can debate, you know, what's intended by that. Blessed are the poor, or poor in spirit. Blessed are they that mourn. The meek. Meek has the sense of someone who bridles their passions. Other translations will sometimes have gentle there because they're in control, right? They're not just acting out or lashing out. The meek person is controlled or constrained. Hungry and thirsty for righteousness. They have a spiritual desire. Merciful means what it sounds like, a person who full of the capacity of mercy. Pure. If you were here Wednesday night, I did my pure devotion because I was studying this and studying James, where the word pure comes up in both places. Purity in the biblical sense doesn't have to do with not sinning, although that would fit. It has to do with being focused on one thing. So think of it this way. Pure water is water and nothing else. A pure heart is focused on one thing and nothing else. And that's the biblical sense of purity, is to be singly devoted to one thing. And so the opposite of pure in the Bible is distracted. You can be pure of heart or have a heart that's trying to serve two masters. Purity is the opposite of trying to do too much. So pure will see God. Peacemakers. That's everyone's favorite, actually, even, you know, outside of Christianity. People like the idea of, you know, getting people to get along, but making peace instead of rivalry and contention. And then the one that, you know, really bugs us is persecuted, those that are persecuted. What do these things have in common? Here's a couple of thoughts. The traits all stress dependence on God, which would make sense if we're talking about blessedness. They stress dependence on God. A poor person can't afford his own meal. He's dependent. Okay, he's in need. A person who mourns, when do you mourn? You mourn when there's nothing else you can do, right? When you are dependent and it seems like it's out of your control, that's when we start mourning. The hungry person, the meek person, again, these are traits that describe a person who is very dependent on God for his life and might not have, the second point, might not have anything of his own to offer up. So it's a person who either doesn't have any personal power or isn't using it. So a poor person, the power in marketplace is money, right? We even use that phrase, how much buying power do you have, right? So if you're poor, you don't have a lot of buying power. There's not a lot you can afford, whether it's food or clothing or a roof over your head, okay? So it's a lack of the ability to do things. The person who mourns, again to repeat, we mourn when there's nothing else we can do. So I'm not trying to get too personal here, but let me just give you an example we'll, I think, all connect with. Someone, the doctor comes in and says, you have cancer. But we've caught it early, and we've got a plan. There's good treatment for this, and we really feel good about this is going to be okay. Well, you're upset, but you're not mourning yet. Doctor comes in and says, Ben, I am very sorry. There is nothing else in modern medicine that we can do. Now what are we doing? Mourning. Because I'm out. There's nothing else I can do. There is nothing I can do to alter this. That's when the mourning kicks in. So as long as we feel like I've got something I can do, then I'm not mourning yet. I'm still fighting, right? I'm in anger mode. I'm going to go beat it, right? But when there's nothing else, that's when we mourn. So the person who mourns over sin is the person that finally realizes, I can't beat this. I can't atone for my own sin. I'm going to have some help. So that person, in a sense, gives up on their own solution, and in mourning is able to turn to God's solution, giving up their own power to do this on their own. One commentator I read made the point, have any of these people ever existed? I don't know if he was being serious or telling a joke, but he said, has anybody ever lived? Has there ever been a church where you look at this list and say, yep, that's them, perfect. And then I read another commentator that said, well, there was one person who was all these things. If you see Jesus at the cross, every one of these is, you know, this perfect description of him. The master of the universe who determines to completely depend on God, completely give up his will to the Father, to not exercise any of his own power. He quite literally is thirsty. He's poor. They take his clothes. I mean, he's up there naked on the cross like a criminal. He has been deposed of all physical ability to do anything. He's left it and given up, and he is in the hands of others and most of all his God, and he says so. Into thy hand I commend my spirit. I am now completely in your hands. And he's persecuted certainly for righteousness' sake. I mean, he's merciful, right? Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. He's pure in heart. He's singular. He's not up there bemoaning his sad estate. He's focused on his task. I mean, the Beatitudes are a perfect description of Jesus at the cross. So the rest of us, we'd like to be that. Jesus actually is, and that's something to be noted as well. Okay, so by way of discussion then, let me give you about 4 minutes here to talk about this. Of all the traits Jesus could have listed, why these? Is this the list you would have picked? There are other lists of important Christian characteristics in the New Testament. If we had one of the kids in here, they could rattle off the fruit of the Spirit for us, but I won't give you a quiz and make you do it. But if you want to look in Galatians 5, 22 to 23, the fruit of the Spirit is listed. And that one kind of makes sense. You know, it's good things to be. And Philippians 4, 8, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honest, whatsoever things are good, whatsoever thing. But that's a list that kind of makes sense of virtue and goodness. But blessed are those who get killed by the other guys. That's a strange list. So what do you think of this list? Why did Jesus put this list together as the introduction to, in Matthew's gospel, his first major sermon? And this is the most important sermon in the recorded text of Jesus. 3-chapter sermon. Here's the opening stanza. Here's the list that defines the disciples of Jesus. What do we think about this list? Why this one? Rosalie says, if we work through this, we'll arrive at an inner peace that's different from what's around us. That this would prepare the disciple for maybe further growth, right? They're now at peace with their Lord and his instructions, and whatever else comes their way, they're ready for that. That makes sense, Josh?
I think it's kind of like what you were talking about this morning. It's kind of a counterculture type idea of, well, people don't consider the poor, the mourning, all these things as being blessed, or, you know, so it's kind of like this turning around of ideas.
So you say he's being a nuisance on purpose. He's flipping all of our ideas backwards to make his point that everything you think about the world is just about backwards, that we've got to be countercultural. What your culture thinks is good is bad, and what it thinks is bad is probably good. And he's going to start by saying, let me give you the most basic things. You think being poor, that's got to be bad. No, being poor in spirit would be good. And so he's just going to start out his teaching by saying, what you know about life is backwards. That's a pretty good interpretation. Yep, David?
I think it's the humility that comes with these truths.
So the humility that comes with this, once you've accepted this kind of dependence on God, you have humbled yourself. So now, whatever Jesus wants to teach next, the humble person is prepared to accept it.
I do know from a personal standpoint that I see God totally different since I was diagnosed with cancer.
Yeah.
It takes situations like that sometimes for a hard-headed guy like me.
Yeah.
But that's kind of, I can identify.
When you're in your own power, then God just looks like one more person in the universe who I might want to have a relationship. Maybe not. He's just one more person.
Especially as a coach, which are all control freaks.
Yeah. I didn't say it, but yeah. See Keith back there going, yeah. Yeah, but yeah, coaches, people, especially in administrative positions and so forth, we are used to being able to say something and people respond. Bill, I mean, president of the university, you know, again, if you say something, people do it, right? This is the opposite of that. This is a reminder that there are things, the real things that matter in life, you have very little control over, and you need the one who does. And yeah, you're right. It does take something like that to get through us hard-headed folks. Preachers are used to that too, by the way. Although, as we said this morning, only 8% of you are apparently listening, according to my statistic this morning. But all right. I'm going to be counting later to see which ones. James?
Huh?
Did you have your hand up?
No.
Randy, you scratched your head. Don't do that when I'm looking. Randy, go ahead.
You know, these are guidelines for us.
Okay. Okay, so this is a statement of what the guidelines would be to help us see what we're doing that would displease God. So if you are, I don't know what rich in spirit would be, but if you think you've got everything you need and you don't need anything from God, that would be displeasurable to God. If you think, well, maybe other people suffer, but not me, that's displeasurable to God. Other people need to be merciful, but not me, that's displeasurable to God. Okay, good thoughts. So let's look at the other half of that then. What happens to these people that have these traits? And again, I just kind of listed them up there. Theirs is the kingdom. They shall be comforted. They shall inherit the earth. Remember that one. We're going to come back to it. The hunger and thirsty will be satisfied. The merciful will receive mercy. The pure in heart will see God. The peacemakers are the sons of God. And the persecuted comes back to the kingdom. Kingdom mentions twice there, beginning and end, which I think is enormously important to help understand it. If you go back to 2 weeks ago, we were in chapter 4, verse 17. From this time forward, Jesus began to teach, repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. His doctrine from this time forward in Matthew is about the kingdom. That's what he's preaching. So he says that in chapter 4, verse 17. And then what's the first sermon? Blessed are they get the kingdom. Blessed are they get the kingdom. This is a sermon about the kingdom. Okay, so I think that's important to the book in there, that you're supposed to connect this. The kingdom of Christ is different than the kingdoms you've known. The kingdom of Christ looks like this. And it's all, as you said, backwards from what we might have expected. So kingdom is repeated, and it's in the present tense. That's interesting. I always try to look at tenses of verbs because, you know, I'm a grammar nerd. I think that's fun. But it's interesting to me here, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven, and he does the same thing in verse 10. Theirs is, which is different. The others are in the future. Peacemakers shall be called the sons of God, but theirs is the kingdom of heaven. I'm not sure what to make of that, except to say Jesus is trying to tell them, the kingdom of heaven is coming upon you right now. It's coming in your midst. Here it comes. And the people that act like this are prepared for it. People who are not prepared for it at all. So Jesus usually talks about the kingdom in the future, but sometimes he does talk present tense. It's right here, right now, and some of you are ready for it, some of you are not. And it's probably not the ones you think, is usually his point. You remember that other passage he says, I want to say Luke. The kingdom cometh not with observation, the kingdom of heaven is within you. Right? I mean, that's present tense. Once in a while, he'll say that. It's not going to be something that you'll see coming over the hills. It's here in the person of Jesus. Others are future tense. And if you want to know why he switches back and forth, you'll have to ask him. I'm not sure. Some he wants to say are already, and some he says are in the future. Maybe it kind of makes sense. Those who mourn, obviously you're not already being comforted, or you wouldn't be mourning. So they're people that are mourning are going to be comforted. But there is a time to that, right? There's a time and place, whether it's about sin. You know, you sin and you mourn and you grieve that, and then comes comfort. Or someone you lose, you mourn and you grieve that, and then comfort. So that could be why it's written that way. In each case, I think the important point is that the shortcoming, the weakness that God calls a blessing, that makes you be dependent on Him, is perfectly met with its counterpart. Okay? So just look at those briefly. The poor get a kingdom. I got news for you. Poor people don't have kingdoms. Rich, powerful armies have kingdoms. No, the poor get a kingdom. Those that mourn shall be comforted. Well, that one makes sense. Okay? Comfort. The meek is a person who doesn't go out and take what he wants. He's restrained and reserved and even gentle. God says the whole earth is his. We're going to come back to that one. The whole earth is his. So other people are trying to take the earth by force. This man doesn't. But he gets what he never asked for. Those who hunger are satisfied. Again, that one makes sense. Merciful receive mercy. How often does Jesus teach that? And you're forgiven as you forgive is one of the bedrocks of Jesus' teaching. The pure in heart see God. You know, I talked about this a little bit Wednesday night. But if you're completely focused on the one thing, and that one thing is the right thing, and it's God, God says you will find it. I think Jesus says this another way in chapter 6. Seek, and you will
find.
Yeah. The pure in heart is someone who is singularly devoted to God. That person finds God. God will not allow himself to be permanently hidden from a person who wants God and nothing else. It just won't be allowed. That gives me a lot of confidence. If I could just have that devotion, it'd be great. Peacemakers and sons of God, there's not an obvious connection in that one. It's good. Sons of God is good. Peacemakers good. But it's not like hunger and satisfied. It's not just immediately obvious. Why are they called the sons of God? It could be, and I'm gonna stretch here, right? So I try to warn you when I'm speculating wildly and when I think I'm right. They're different. This is me speculating wildly. In the Old Testament, some of the powerful kings were called sons of God. Okay? The men who conquered nations and beat the Philistines were sons of God. That king was a son of God, a powerful man. So could it be that Jesus is saying, in his kingdom, it's not the conquering warlord, it's the people who make peace with others who are going to be my children? Maybe. Or it could be nothing to do with that. but I'm really not sure what the connection is otherwise, because it's not common to see that phrase, son of God. The Old Testament, it's usually a king, if it's used at all. We see the New Testament applied to Jesus. 1 John chapter 3 said, behold, what manner of love the Father hath bestowed upon us that we should be called the sons of God. But again, what's the connection between that and peacemaker? Not exactly clear. Some have said peacemaker has to do with the gospel of peace. So you're out preaching the gospel, and so the sons of God are out preaching the gospel, maybe. Okay, so that one's a little bit difficult to see the connection. But then again, here at the last, persecuted, theirs is the kingdom. Well, the persecuted are the people who don't have a kingdom, right? The Roman kingdom is doing the persecuting. And Jesus says, no, the persecuted people get the kingdom. So in each case, the shortcoming, with maybe one exception I don't understand, the shortcoming is met with perfect fulfillment. If you give up on yourself and trust completely in God, God does more than you would have guessed possible. My question for discussion, what about verse 5 and verse 12? Verse 12, great is your reward in heaven, but the meek inherit the earth. So I'll tell you a funny story. I was in a Bible class, and the teacher said, now, when it says the meek inherit the earth, that means heaven. And I said, well, I appreciate what you're trying to do there. But if Jesus says earth, you can't say it means the opposite of earth, right? So it's like if Jesus said, go up, what he meant was down. Whatever earth means, you can't just plug in the word heaven there and say, well, you know, earth means heaven, because they're almost exactly opposites. So it is a little hard to figure out what he's saying. This is a passage where our Jehovah's Witness friends kind of take a particular view. They say, this little ball of earth, God's going to give it to you. You're going to be kings and lords here. And I think they've missed the boat entirely, because I don't know what they do with verse 12. Great is your reward in heaven, right? So what do you make of, what have you heard? You've heard sermons, I'm sure. What have you heard people say about the meek shall inherit the earth? What does that mean? I'm curious. If you tell me nobody has ever preached on the Sermon on the Mount to you, I'm going to be really unhappy. We're going to talk to all your past preachers. Go ahead, David.
In a reference to Psalms 37:11, it says, "The meek shall inherit the land and delight themselves in abundant peace." So,
with Israel, I mean, it makes sense that it would have been quite literally that chunk of ground they were standing on. If you're meek and obey God, He gives you this spot right here. So in the Psalm, that makes sense to me. It could be, I'll just throw this out there, again, kind of thinking as I go here. I had some thoughts, but now they're all left my head, as they do. The temptation of Jesus in Matthew chapter 4, that's just the previous chapter. What was one of the things that Satan offered to Jesus? All the kingdoms of the earth, if you would follow me. So what could be going on is Satan says to us, if you want the things that matter in this life, all the kingdoms of the earth, you have to serve Satan. And Jesus says, actually, that's not how you reach your goals. That's not actually, if you want heaven and earth both, if you want everything that matters in life, if you want the things that actually matter, which may not be the things you think they are, if you want the earth, the sum total of what God wants for your life, even right now, not just in heaven, but right now, it's not through submitting to Satan, though he promises you the earth. God's the master of the earth. The Old Testament scriptures say it's his footstool. If anybody could give you the earth, it'd be him, not Satan. So it might be a direct connection to that passage where Satan says, I could give you the earth. And Jesus says, no. The meek, God will give them the earth. That they're the ones who God elevates. Yep.
And I would say the operative word is inheritance. That this is a glorious and tremendous inheritance. It's in fact an inheritance of everything you can possibly imagine. Mm-hmm. The whole earth is your inheritance.
That's a good way to think of it. That again, the power-hungry person thinks, I've got to take what I want. God says, I could give you everything you can imagine. And that's another phrase Jesus uses. What would a man give in exchange for his soul? If he gained the whole world and lose his soul, would it be worthwhile? So again, earth or world could stand for everything you could ever want. But the meek person doesn't take it by force. If you depend on God, everything, maybe not that you want, but everything that you should have wanted, God will supply. Is that kind of where you were going with that? Thereabouts? A great inheritance. Yeah. Earth-size inheritance. James, did you have your hand up or did you scratch your head again?
No, I actually raised my hand. That,
okay.
I mean, I was thinking about the prodigal son's father, what he said to his older brother, all that I have is yours.
Yeah.
I mean, is that along that, those lines?
Yeah, I mean, we do forget. Sometimes we become very Gnostic almost and we start talking about, well, we're going to get out of here and go to heaven and that's what it's all about. And great is your reward in heaven, that's good. But our father runs this place too. And the prodigal son, the other son, was told, all of this belongs to your father. I mean, what did you really lack anything? Your God took care of you. The psalmist says, my father has cattle on 1,000 hills. Everything you see belongs to my father. And so if I become his heir, what would I lack? So it may not be something literal like you get the deed to the earth, but that in this life even, you get what you need because this belongs to him. And in the life to come, more than you could have guessed. That's maybe. Yeah. So think on that one. I don't have a clear answer, but it's an interesting passage. It's definitely one we trip over a little bit because we're not used to thinking of. In fact, usually the preacher says the opposite, doesn't he? Well, you don't want what's down here below. We're going somewhere else. And then Jesus says, well, you inherit the earth. I'm like, okay. What does he mean by that? But the inherit word, I think, is very helpful. Okay, one more set of questions, and the lesson will be yours tonight. Once again, my nerdiness comes out in the grammar here. Did you notice while we read these that none of these were commands? They are all statements of fact. Blessed are these. So a command would say, Ben, be pure in heart. It doesn't say, Ben, be pure in heart. It doesn't even say, be pure in heart. It says, blessed are the pure in heart. So it's just a statement of fact, which is kind of interesting. What other set of documents looks like that? The Ten Commandments. And it's funny, because we call them the Ten Commandments. Not a one of them is an imperative. It doesn't say, do not kill, even though some of the translations have tried. It says, you will not kill. Or in the King James, thou shalt not kill. It's just a statement of fact. You will not do it. Which I think we can understand as a command, and that's why we call them the Ten Commandments. When my father said, you will be home at 10 o'clock, I understood that not to be a description, but a command that I was to obey or suffer the wrath of the one high atop the mountain, right? I mean, you can state things like that and mean it as commands. And so I think everyone who ever read the Ten Commandments, you will not kill, understood that God was saying, don't kill, right? But it's interesting that he chooses to word it that way. It's not a request. It's not a suggestion. It's not even an instruction. It is a statement of fact. My people will not kill. Here in the Blessed Beatitudes, the poor are blessed. The meek will inherit the earth. The persecuted are in the kingdom of heaven. Just statements of fact. And so the commentators have a lot of different ideas on what to do with that, but I thought I would just throw it out to you. Why does he say it that way? Would it have been interesting if he maybe started out with just a set of commandments? Here are Jesus' Ten Commandments, like Moses or something, you know. Don't be impure of heart, be pure of heart. Don't be a troublemaker, be a peacemaker. But he doesn't say it that way. Just as a statement of fact to his disciples, the peacemakers will be blessed and they will be called the sons of God. Period. Statement of fact. What does that mean to you? And I'm not saying that subjectively. What does that make you think? When he says it that way, how is that different than saying it the other way?
You have a choice.
You have a choice. How so? Tell me more.
You're either good or evil.
So this is just a statement of reality. This is the way it's going to be. He's not even telling you have to do it. This, in our parenting class down the hall, we've been talking about this method of parenting, that you just state things in terms of reality with your kids. And you just say, this is the way it's going to be. I'm not angry and I'm not mad. This is the way it is. If you do that, this will happen. And it's up to you. I'm not going to yell at you until you do it. I'm not going to nag you until you do it. This is it, and I'm going to follow through. And help kids to learn that there's such a thing as reality. Imagine that. Such a thing as reality that they don't get to get around. Well, this is God's reality, and you get a choice. You don't have to be pure in heart. But the pure in heart are blessed and will see God. If you want to be blessed and see God, you do have to be pure in heart. But it's up to you. This is just reality. This is a fact. This is how God manages the universe. It's a good way of looking at it. I like that.
You have to kind of look at this like these are promises.
Okay, they're promises?
Yes.
Okay.
Because that's what, you know, the outcome will be.
Yeah.
If you are this way.
So this is, if it's a promise, that's really helpful, especially if it's already happened to you, right? So if you're, remember Jesus said this to people, and then Matthew wrote it down and the church read it. And when Matthew wrote it down and the church read it, they were already being persecuted. It's nice. They didn't need the commandment to be persecuted. They were doing it just fine. They needed the promise that said, the persecuted are blessed. The persecuted get the kingdom. So that's a promise that's helpful. It's a more positive way of doing it. Anything else on that? Any thoughts? A few of the commentators want to make this a temporary thing, where this was Jesus just describing the early church, and it wasn't meant to last. And I think that's interesting because of how desperate we are to get around the Beatitudes. Because they are so, I mean, as David said, they're such, once you get it through your head, it's so life-altering. It would be a lot easier to get around it. And I was really surprised by how many of the commentators said, this is not really expected of us, but the early church needed this, and okay, fine. I just don't take it that way. I think Jesus really intended this is the new reality. And maybe we fell asleep. I got 2 minutes left, so let me do it. Maybe in American history we fell asleep, and there was this brief period of history where Christian people, vaguely Christian people, were at peace in a country that admired their virtues and characteristics and didn't really persecute them. And that was just the way it was, and we thought, oh, that's normal. And maybe we kind of forgot that for the other 19 centuries, more often if you're a Christian, it hurts. More often if there's a Christian, there's opposition. And so maybe we had a brief little dream called, you know, peaceful Christianity, and we forgot that that's not actually normal. This may be more normal for our children and grandchildren than we might guess. Something to chew on. Just to depress you on a Sunday night. There you go. But the good news is, Jesus says, that's fully to be expected. And it is a blessing. Because God has said so. And that's good news. Okay, thank you. Appreciate your attention. More Sermon on the Mount next week, Lord willing.